This is Bernard Stonehouse, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of December, 2011. Bernard Stonehouse, Part 1.
Well, name's Bernard Stonehouse. I was born on the 1st of May, 1926. I think the whole country went on strike about that time. And I was born in Hull, Hull, Yorkshire.
What was your father's profession?
Well, he had a business in skins, I think he was called a low grade skin merchant, which meant that it was sheep skins and rabbit skins rather than the sables and things like that. But he was hit very hard by the Depression and he lost his business in about 1928 and never quite recovered from it. So he tried several other things. He was in business, but he wasn't a businessman. And I can sympathise with him now because I think that's why I've always avoided going into business myself. I just wouldn't be right for it in the way that he wasn't. So I think it was a warning to me.
What about further education for you? Where did you go?
I was at primary school and then the Hull Grammar School, which was a very good one, a good old-fashioned grammar school. And this was just coming up to wartime, so I was when war broke out in 1939, I was evacuated with the school to Thorne, which is near Doncaster in Yorkshire. It's about 40 miles away, and I could cycle home every weekend if I felt like it, which I did usually. And then we returned to Hull in 1944, I think it was probably, and by that time I'd signed up for the Navy. So I left school, went to Hull University College, which was my local university college at the time, because that was somehow involved in the Y entry scheme for the Navy, that's the youth entry scheme. I could do some of my pre-entry training there. So it was Hull University for 3 or 4 months while I was waiting to go into the Navy, and then they hauled me in, and that was fine. And that was all my formal education apart from the Navy until quite a bit later when I came out and then went to the Antarctic, came back from the Antarctic, and then completed a degree course at University College London.
What drew you to the Navy?
Well, I think a lot of our friends around where we lived in Hull, North Hull, were master mariners and people connected with shipping and engineers. And a seaman, and they were sort of role models for me in a sense. I liked them, I liked what they did, I liked the idea of travelling and so on, and I'd rather line myself up for the Merchant Navy as a possible career. And then when it became apparent that the war was going to continue a bit longer and I'd better get into it. Certainly the Navy rather than the... I wanted to fly, but I also wanted to go to sea, so I joined the Fleet Air Arm, which was the obvious thing to do. I was very surprised when I was accepted for it because I didn't think I was strong enough or healthy enough or whatever. I was not athletic or in any sense. I was the original 7-stone weakling, I think, at the time. It used to advertise for in the advertisement for bodybuilding.
You'd send sixpence in stamps.
That's right. Yes, that's right. He was the one who always...
Charles Atlas.
Charles Atlas course, is that is it, yeah. yes, I didn't do a Charles Atlas course, but I always felt one down when I looked at that advertisement. Anyhow, I passed the medical, and that was fine. And then the Navy helped to build me up a little bit, which was a very good thing. We went after some after the pre-flight training, which was at Gosport in Hampshire. We went over to Canada and sailed in the Queen Elizabeth when she was a troop ship. And then I was very fortunate because we were trained in flying by the Canadian Air Force. And they were absolute leaders at the time in building people up physically. And whereas the Navy did a lot of knees bend, arm stretch sort of thing, Canadian Air Force was way ahead of that and did some very, very good exercising. We did a lot of things like playing water polo, which is very good indeed for your strengthening your stomach muscles and so on, which was important for flying, particularly if you're going to be sort of weaving about. So weaving and dodging, you need fairly good strong stomach muscles. They did all that. And so apart from the flying training I got, I also got some very good some physical build-up, which was useful.
The interest in flying, can you find a source for that? Can you put your finger on what it was that made you want
to
take
no, it? Oh, no, but it was the thing to do then. The heroes of that war were, of course, the Battle of Britain pilots, and then, of course, the pilots who were going, taking the war over to Germany every night and so on. So, but partly that, but I also liked the idea of flying. And when I started, I'd never been in an aircraft before, I did this training, I found I took to it. I was never going to be a brilliant pilot, but I could manage. And I liked the independence of it, or the fact that you were... I was not in a mob of 20 other people marching or anything like that. You had a certain independence for it. And the three-dimensional thing was very nice. And it was a very interesting training course. And I took to it like a duck to water, I suppose.
There are other specialities you had. I mean, I'm interested to know where your interest in zoology seems to have sprung from, because that was what you did later in life.
Yes, I think I did biology at school because for A-levels, as they were then, you could do physics and chemistry and mathematics. And I hated mathematics. I didn't like physics. And I was interested in chemistry, but there was also the option of doing biology, zoology and botany, in fact. Those appealed to me far more than either physics or certainly more than physics or maths. I was never going to be an engineer or anything like that. So I think I took biology because it seemed to offer more things that I might enjoy, and again, I took to it very well. I enjoyed it and became very interested in animals and plants and how they worked, and the whole thing. I became very much immersed in it. So I read, I took courses in zoology and I think geography at Hull University College, but this was just everybody agreed this was just sort of filling in time. Until I went into the Navy. But I found that what I did in zoology there was very interesting, and I thought, right, well, this is what I'm going to do when this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a zoologist. And I didn't quite know. Of course, there were lots of opportunities then for working in the colonies, in the Commonwealth. You could become an entomologist in Kenya or something like that, or go to India and tell them how to run their animals and plants and so on. So it was something with a future. My mother had put me down for the post office when I was five, which was a thing you did then. Of course, there was no my family had absolutely no background in university life at all. And this was a time when you paid to go to the university, and of course we wouldn't have been able to afford it. So the whole university idea was new, and it opened up all these possibilities. And then, of course, at the end of the war, as an ex-serviceman, I was entitled to a further education and training scheme grant, which was what got me to London. But and by that time, of course, I'd had 3 years in the Antarctic, and I was completely hooked on penguins and seals and things like that. So,
well, that's the final piece of the jigsaw in your prehistory is where this interest for the Antarctic sprang from. What's your first awareness that the Antarctic existed as a place?
I don't know. It wasn't in my Hull background at all. I didn't know anybody. In fact, quite a few Antarctic explorers have come from Hull, but there was no connection there that I knew of. No, the Antarctic first came up because my brother-in-law, who had married my sister during the war, when they were both in the services, went on Operation Tabarin. Now, he was a zoologist.
Is this Marshall?
Freddie Marshall, or yeah. Norman Marshall. He was one of our lodgers. And he was a zoologist, and I liked him very much, and I liked his attitude to... he was interested in fish, which I was not particularly interested in, but he introduced me to one or two other biologists at Hull when we were there at the university. And I think that's probably where it came from. Then he went on Operation Tabarin, which was secret at the time, so he just disappeared. Nobody knew where he'd gone to. And then when he came back, he said, well, he'd been to the Antarctic for 18 months, and it was a nice place, because it's a good place to go, a good place to go and do some work. So I think he got me interested, and then after the war, when I was still in the Navy, and I was, by this time I was commissioned, and I was doing a rather dull job because the war was over, and I was an education officer, and it wasn't very exciting. Opportunity came up to go on to the successor to Operation Tabarin, which was the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey. An order came around the fleet saying they wanted somebody, I think they wanted a meteorologist. Well, I wasn't a meteorologist, but I'd done meteorology in my flying training. I'd never read a barometer in my life that I could remember. but I put in for it, and to my complete astonishment, was accepted for that. Because I also had the flying background now, and they were taking an aircraft down to the Antarctic for the first time with FIDS. And they had a pilot already, and another fleet air arm chap. But I could say, well, if they wanted an emergency or a second pilot or something, I could probably fly their aircraft for them, and I'd do the meteorology at the same time. So that's how I became involved in the Antarctic myself.
I appreciate it was a long time ago, but do you remember anything of the interview process? Was it rigorous?
Not at all. I think James Wordy was on the committee. The Bishop of Portsmouth was. Now, he'd been on the British Grahamland expedition. And Brian Roberts, who was a sort of polar guru at the time, he also was on the BGLE, had been. And a chap from the Colonial Office who didn't seem to know very much about anything, but as they were providing the money, he had to sit on it too. It wasn't in the least rigorous. I turned up and we chatted for half an hour, and I said what I'd been doing and so on, what my qualifications might be. And I admitted I'd never read a barometer, but I work on the principle of what one fool can do, another can. And so they said yes, and I said, now I want to go to a base where I can do some biological work. penguins, or I don't know quite what, but if I can get involved in the biology, I'd like to. This was really as Freddie Marshall had been able to do. He was at Hope Bay. Now, I remember the chap from the Colonial Office said, well, I expect you'll be able to do some shrimping in your spare time. So that was my introduction to my career in Antarctic biology. I don't remember anything of the other two. Wordy, I think, kept very quiet. Brian Roberts asked one or two questions, which didn't seem relevant at all to anything that I could think of. The Bishop of Portsmouth was a very good man. Was very interested in people going to the Antarctic and what they were going to get out of it. He was by far the most thoughtful, I should say, on the whole of the interview process. He asked me questions about how I was likely to be able to stand being away for a couple of years and things like that. And I said, well, the end of the war, practically every man of my age has been away from home and away from the world for months and months and months. And I thought I could probably do as well as they had.
Did you have any concerns or reservations? Was there something that you...
No, not at all. Once I got the idea that I wanted to go, then I wanted to go. Freddie had told me quite a lot about living at the base and so on. He didn't say a lot about it, but he told me that it was a good way of... You've got plenty of opportunity to sit and think and to absorb new things. If you were in with a good crowd, that was fine. You were in good company and you could enjoy the very limited social life there was. And I wasn't apprehensive about it. It all seemed fairly safe and straightforward. I had no idea what I was going to be doing apart from reading the barometer every three times a day and so on, and possibly doing a bit of flying, but I had no other ideas at all about it, so I wasn't worried about it or anything like that.
Were there any parental concerns?
Oh, well, my mother was always worried that I wasn't going into the post office.
Life would have been very different, wouldn't it?
Yes. And anything other than that, she was highly dangerous. She said when I joined the Navy, I'd probably sign my death warrant, which I hadn't. And by that time, I think she was used to the idea that I was going to do something absolutely daft, and this was as daft as it could get, so that's fine. But Freddie had survived it and come back, and so I might.
So that was on your side?
Yes.
That was in your favour?
Yep.
What, if anything, do you record about the period between being appointed and actually setting sail? Was there rigorous training?
No, absolutely not at all. I went, but I was stationed at an air station at Arbroath, HMS Condor, where I was doing a job of educational and vocational training and so on. I was doing a bit of flying there because they were training navigators, and I got a little bit involved in that. So I did a... it was sort of schoolmastering sort of thing rather than actually flying in Anson's, which are a twin engine, a small bombers, I suppose. We were flying all around Scotland, the Scottish coast, and so and that was quite. I enjoyed seeing the land from the air. By that time, I'd picked up enough geology and geography to be able to appreciate that you could, if you took a navigation map up with you, that was one thing. If you took a geological map up with you, you could see a hell of a lot more. And that came out later on when I was flying in England after the Antarctic.
And the book.
Yes, but it was a... I was very busy with that, and then suddenly I was told when the ship would sail, and the Navy gave me leave to start my secondment, as it was going to be. And then they changed their minds and said no. As I was going to be paid by the Colonial Office, they were not going to pay me any more, so they put me onto the reserve, which was fine. I had a week in London, I suppose, and I met one or two friends there and so on, and then. And then off we went.
Was the Antarctic what you hoped when you got there? What were your first impressions?
Well, I'd seen photographs. We were at a place which was quite unfamiliar because nobody had written about it that I knew of. I realised when I got there that this was going to be quite different from Scott and Shackleton and so on, because they were working around the other side of the Antarctic and in higher latitudes generally. So we were not going to have the extreme conditions that they had. We got to the Falklands, and I spent about a month in the Falklands waiting for... We went to the Falklands in a passenger ship, the Lafonia, which was the one that was going to be running between the Falklands and Montevideo for the next few years. And I was waiting in the Falklands for the expedition ship to come in, which was a thing called the Trapassi, which was a sealer from Newfoundland. So I had that month... I was reading what I could in the public library and also in the library at Government House, because we met the governor and talked about this and that, and he said, well, he had a job for somebody who might be interested to just organising the Government House library. So I did that.
Cosmo King?
The governor at the time was... Ginger Jeff. I've forgotten
his name. Don't worry, we'll look it up.
I've forgotten his name.
So you're in his library?
But it's a Government House library, and it did need sorting out, but it had some very good historic accounts and so on, so I was able to do some reading there and learned about the Discovery expeditions, which had been based partly in the Falkland Islands. That was from 1925 onwards. And they gave me some insights into what the Antarctic Peninsula was going to be about, because of course that's where they'd done a lot of their work, where the whaling was going on. So that was useful. It was a useful introduction to that side of the Antarctic. And so when I got down there, I think I was very impressed with the scenery. And the ice and the snow and so on. We called in at one or two of the other bases. I spent 3 weeks in charge at Deception Island while the ship went off, I think, to Hope Bay and did some other work before they could take us down to all the way down to Marguerite Bay, which was where I was going to be stationed. So that was my introduction to it. A Deception was a dreary place. I was very glad not to be having to spend a year there. At the end of my first year, they said, well, if you've had enough of Base E, would you like to come and be the base leader at Deception Island? And I said, no, thank you very much. having seen it, I was much happier where I was.
Where else were there other places of call, other bases you saw on the way down to Stonington?
No, I don't think so. I think we went from Deception. Well, we may have called in at Base F, the Argentine Islands. Yes, I think we must have done. Because I think that was just starting up, or they were looking for somewhere to build the... to build a base F, and then we went on down to Base E in this little sealer, We were under sail part of the time. The engine, I think we had trouble with the engines or something, but they put up a sail and we... So I went down to Basie under sail, or partly under sail.
Give me a little thumbnail sketch of Basie as you found it in 1947.
This was early 47, January of 47, I think. Is that right? Yes, I think. Yes, that's right. Well, it was a shed, rather elaborate shed, nicely built, pine, a double walled and so on, a single story, set very well in the side of a slight rise in an island with the glacis in behind. It was on that particular island because the Americans under Admiral Byrd had built an American base on Donnington Island. Mm-hmm. And Byrd's policy when he had, for his expedition, which was 1939 to 1941, was to set up, he was the first one to think of setting up permanent bases and renewing the people every year. Because previously everybody had gone down for a year or possibly 2 years and then a sort of raid and then come back and abandon the base and everything in it. He was the first one to think of this idea of permanent bases, which of course, as he was well aware, indicated occupation or constituted occupation. So we put down Basie on the same island. The Americans had chosen that island because it was one of the very few islands where you had a ramp of ice up onto the main peninsula. A glacier came right down onto the island, and you could get your dog teams and your stores and things up there. That's why they chose it, and of course we chose it for now. These are two reasons: one, that you could do that and get onto the plateau from there, but also that it was preempting any return that the Americans might have made. I always feel that we were there not to keep the Argentines and the Chileans out, because they hadn't even started. They were making noises, but they hadn't actually built bases at that time. But the Americans had built a base there. And, of course, another one over on the other side of the continent. And although Byrd was not getting the support of his government in claiming Antarctica, he was making a lot of noise about the Americans claiming Antarctica, and this was... I've never been able to establish this because every time I've asked the colonial or the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for the papers at the time, they always tell me they're missing.
What is your suspicion?
Sorry?
What is your suspicion, though?
Well,
were you there?
They're in a cleft stick. The Americans were our allies. But on the other hand, they had built a base on territory that Britain was claimed to be ours. And although Byrd's claims have been repudiated by the American government, he was still very much in business. And they had the basis of an occupation. Now, of course, that was upsetting the Chileans and the Argentines as well. They'd been stirred up by Byrd, probably more than we had. But people tend to forget that it was the Americans putting down that base on Donnington Island that got the whole thing started up. And you might say, well, the Americans stirred up the Chileans and the Argentines, and then we had to come in because the Chileans and the Argentines were there. But I'm pretty certain that when they were working out the need for Operation Tamarin in wartime, the fact that the Americans were there was not by any means a negligible something that they were not taking into consideration. Anyhow.
So politics may have got you there, but once you were there, did that all then get washed away and you were left to get on with other things?
Well, yes, essentially. We were... Our terms of reference were to occupy the base, to expand it, which we did. We built Nissen huts and things onto it, improve it so that we would be able to live there year after year after year. Because, of course, we'd adopted this policy now of the permanent bases and that the Americans had tried and hadn't succeeded at, we were doing. And to improve the base and make it more comfortable and so on, to survey from there, to survey the local area, that was fine. We had two surveyors on the team. We were the main base. We had about 100 Huskies outside, which I got very much involved with. We had the aircraft. And our job was to survey the local area and then to find routes up onto the plateau and over the plateau to the other side so we could continue the survey on the Weddell Sea side and also to go down south from there to King George's Six Sound and explore down there. Now, the Americans had done quite a lot of that. In the year that they'd been in their base from Stonington Island, they'd done some very, very good sledging at Yernis. They included Finn Ronnie, who was American, who had been on a bird's expeditions, as his father had before him. They'd done some very, very good survey, and we were building partly on what they'd done. So we had a very busy time, and also, of course, to keep the standard meteorological records and things like that, and to collect geological specimens and biological, and so on. So we had terms of reference that we worked within, but how we set about it was very much up to us. To the leader at the base that year had been the radio operator in the previous year. And although he hadn't been a sledging man, he'd been the radio operator, so he'd had to stay home for the year. But he was very keen to get out and do some sledging himself, which he did. This was a Ken Butler, a Ken Elm, a Pierce Butler, He was a fairly independent spirit. He was great fun in a lot of ways, and he liked pulling the leg of the colonial office when they interfered too much. If we got orders from the government or from the governor of the Falkland Islands and so on. And we didn't like them. Well, we had trouble with the radio, so we appreciated what they were trying to do, but we felt that as we were on the spot and we knew what the overall plan was, then it was up to us to organise it in the most sensible way that we could. And of course, we did. And we were, on the whole, very efficient at what we were doing.
Who were the other key characters that year, the ones that stand out in your memory most?
Oh, there are some of the most interesting people I've ever been with. Four of the 11 had decorations from World War II. We'd all been in the services to one degree or another. I mean, my contribution had been tiny compared with John Tonkin, who was a military cross. He'd been in the SAS, the original SAS. Kevin Walton, who got a distinguished service across the Navy, was an engineer officer for keeping a destroyer's engines going during an operation. Tommy Thompson, the pilot, who was a pilot, had a distinguished service cross for, I think, for sinking a submarine off the west coast of Britain in a swordfish, you know, stringback, and so on. They were first class. They were very good company. They're older than I was. They were mostly in their sort of mid-20s. I had my 21st birthday there in the first year. But they were very good. They were very good company, and I learned a great deal from them. And they accepted the younger chaps very gracefully. And we got on extremely well together. It was a good base, very good base.
So if you all had military experience, did that kind of filter into the way the base was run? Was it run like a military establishment?
Yes, but very much a tongue-in-cheek.
Can you elaborate?
We had a scrubbing out every Saturday morning. That was called barrack room sports. Things like this. And whoever was in charge of the stores was known as a pusser. Well, that was from the Navy, of course. So this was all pusser stores. You had a lot of the terminology that came in, and a lot of the humour was very much service based, and that helped a lot. I think in that year all of us had been commissioned, and we'd all, to one degree or another, learnt that the services were a very good thing, but you didn't take them seriously. At least you didn't try to take them too seriously. And nobody ever pulled rank on anybody else or anything like that. That would have been too silly for words. We'd have all rolled about laughing. But then, and nobody took any account of what rank had held. One of the outstanding characters was the air fitter, who'd been a sergeant engineer, a flight engineer, who'd been one of the few who'd been in the permanent services. He was in pre-war in the RAF.
He'd done who was he?
Training at Holt. And David Jones. He died a few years ago, unfortunately, but he was a salt of the earth. And apart from dealing with the aircraft, he dealt with the generators and the carpentry and everything else. He was very handy and very good. He made a brass key for my 21st birthday, so I would have the key of the door. He sort of got down to the workshop and got that sorted out in a way that I don't think any other of us would have thought of it. But he saw the need for a piece of kit, and he gravelled around and found the raw materials for it, and then did a beautiful job of finishing it off. And he was doing that all the time, you know, finding things that needed doing and actually doing them. He'd been a prisoner of war for 3 years because he'd been shot down over Germany, and then he'd been on the march from the Polish camps to across. He'd had a hell of a war, and so 2 years in the Antarctic and then a compulsory third one, it didn't really worry him all that much. He'd seen it all before. Much worse.
Was it completely harmonious, the group?
Yes, there were tensions from time to time because we were all very positive people, but there was a great deal of very good humour too, and that simply discharged all the tensions that I think at other bases must have built up and I mean nobody ever you could lose your temper over something, but it was usually over something outside. It wasn't over other people. And the other people could commiserate with you and so on. No, it was, again, I learned a hell of a lot from this. I learned a lot about how men should behave when they're together and in straitened circumstances and how to keep things under control.
At some point, the Americans returned, didn't they? They weren't there when you arrived.
No, they rolled up when I'd been there about a month, I suppose.
What more can you say about that incident? Because there was a bit of a rumpus, I believe.
Well, you had 23, I think it was 23 Americans. There were 11 of us, of course. There were 23 of them. Finn Ronnie was a very awkward man indeed. He was of Norwegian background, Norwegian American, engineer officer in the Navy, in the U.S. Navy, a commander, engineer commander. Very hard headed. Very competent sledger and so on, but absolutely no idea of how to run people, how to deal with people. I wouldn't have liked his job of running these 22 awkward bastards who constituted the American.
Why were they so awkward and you not? They were on a
completely different wavelength. They came over and marvelled at us from time to time. Because we were living in a very civilised society, a very civilised little group. We had this hut, the main living room, had the bunks around the walls. We had a polished table because we'd bloody well made it out of planking. We went and we kept it polished, and that was one of the things we did at Barrack Room Sports every Saturday. We had curtains at the windows. It was a very homely little place. They moved into this barrack that had been set up in 1939, I think it was, which had no windows at all except some skylights. They lived in a very slovenly way. They didn't bother to keep the place clean and tidy and so on. Each of them had his own little area, all open across the centre, except the two who were married and had their wives with them, and they had sort of huts out on the edges somewhere. And they had no idea of how to live in a civilised way. Individually, there were some very nice ones among them, and they were the ones who tended to come over to us and heave a sigh of relief and sit down and have a cup of tea in a cup with a saucer and eat homemade scones, because this was something we turned on just about every day. We lived very simply, but in a very civilised way. And the idea of having a shelf up there was or bottles of whiskey and gin and sherry astonished them. He said, well, you know, that would disappear in 2 minutes if it was in our base. And we said, well, it's there. We have a bung-ho night every Friday. If we feel like a party, we find out whose birthday it is. It might be one of ours, or it might be Charlie Chaplin's birthday, or something, but something to celebrate. And we have a celebration. Nobody gets drunk. Nobody gets... I mean, it's just bloody silly to get drunk in a place like the Antarctic. You can go outside for a pee and end up in a snowdrift. Well, it's just not the thing you want to. You know, it's not the way you want to live.
So did they then? Did they not have a military background? The Americans, were they?
No, a lot of them had, but it was again. It's a different military, you see. Now Finn Ronnie was trying to run a ship. Ken Butler wasn't trying to run an army unit. Ken Butler knew that if he did it, he'd find himself outside with the door locked. but Finn, the first rule was no drink.
The Americans were dry, were they?
Americans were, well, officially they were dry. No drink had been brought down. But I think what they did more than anything else in that place was brewing. And they had two of them in particular were from the Ozarks and knew all about making
stills.
The cook, Sigatenko, complained that within a month of them coming ashore, he had no raisins left, he had no prunes, he had nothing that could be brewed was left in his stores. It all disappeared. Well, we knew where quite a lot of it was going on, because if you went into the meteorological office at certain times, the smell was overpowering. This was when they just started up a new brew. And it was bubbling away under the floorboards. No, it was a seismo shack, seismology shack. They had a couple of seismos that had to be kept in the dark because they had light beams and so on. So nobody could go in there, you see. Even the base commander couldn't go in there without upsetting the record. So it was under the floorboards there that the main brewing was going on. And being clever chaps, they'd arrange for ventilation and everything else. Everything would work very well. And they made these foul brews and got completely honked on them from time to time. They looked after each other. I mean, there was no.
Did you ever try any of this hooch?
Yes, I did once, but I was the sort of thing you might clean your buttons with, but I wouldn't.
The other area of contention, or possible areas of contention between the Brits and the Americans, were A, women, and B, dogs, and not necessarily in that order.
Well, the two women were perfectly reasonable. They were both perfectly reasonable girls who, the wife of the commander, Jackie Ronnie, had, I think, been a secretary in his office and was a fairly simple, straightforward, and had done his typing for him and so on, and then they'd married. The other, Jenny Darlington, was married to Harry Darlington. Now, she was from the American upper crust. They were wealthy, very wealthy indeed. I forget where the Darlington money comes from, but it's railroads or something, two or three generations back. It might have been banking, might have been railroads, but something of the kind. And they were reputed to be, each of them, a millionaire in his or her own right, and I would think that was quite likely. Harry was, I found him a very awkward chap. He'd been a Navy pilot. He and Finn Ronnie got across each other very, very quickly. He was supposed to be the lead pilot for the expedition, but for some reason he and Finn got across each other. The two wives were loyal to their own husbands, so that meant that they couldn't, although they'd been brought down as a company for each other, they were not hardly on speaking terms at all. And so you immediately got the expedition was divided. There were the pro-Finn people, not many, and the pro-Harry people, but then not many people liked him either. So you had a sort of rump in the middle who didn't like anybody, but got on with it. Now, they were great. I mean, we had a lot of fun with them. They were nice individually. Some of them were very nice people. And they got things done. And the pilots were very competent pilots and so on. But they were so different from us. And they, to some degree, I think they envied us the sort of social life we were living, but didn't know how to set that up in their own situation. And it would have been very difficult because they were quite different. They were quite different backgrounds, different people and so on. The dogs were... That was serious. That was a much more serious matter because they'd lost quite a lot of their dogs on the way south in the ship, the Port of Beaumont. And they called in, I think, at Valparaiso. And I was told that to make up the numbers of dogs, they'd simply gone around the city at night and picked up dogs. Certainly it was a very motley crowd. I think any dog that stood more than 2 feet high was grabbed, whether it was a Labrador or a greyhound or what the hell it was. And they brought this mob ashore, and we were appalled. But, well, first of all, it wasn't fair on the dogs because they weren't husky and they weren't dressed for it. Secondly, they had absolutely no training. I mean, there's no question of them being trained dogs. I mean, they may have been trained to play the bugle or something, but they weren't trained as sledge dogs. And thirdly, we were very concerned that they were going to bring any sort of disease over to our mob, who we cherished. I mean, our dogs were extremely valuable to what we were doing. And Finrani assured us that the two need never meet and so on. But then some of their dogs got off and came over to ours, obviously, and barked at them. It was an impossible situation. And we were appalled that they'd hijacked of dogs who were probably other people's pets and be brought them to the Antarctic with the any intention of trying to do sledging with them. And it turned out every time we tried to cooperate with them over their dog teams, it was always their teams who let us down because they were nowhere near the standard of competence that ours were, which is not surprising.
Did you ever have any face-to-face conversations with the two women, or...?
No, they used to come over. They never, after the first week or so, when this row brewed up between the husbands, they never came over together. But one would come, and sometimes one would go out the back door when the other one was coming in through the front door.
So, like Brian Ricks.
Because we didn't want any part of it. I won't say we had problems of our own, but we didn't want problems of that kind. We made it perfectly clear if they had trouble over on their side of the hill, they could keep it there. They were very welcome to come over and see us, and we always had a sort of open house about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when we made the scones, and if we felt the Americans were coming over, we'd make a few extra ones. And
it didn't cause any problems with young men stirring and things. Suddenly being confronted with a woman in the party.
No, of course, some of us had been there for 2 years by that time. I'd only just arrived. They were, as far as I was concerned, they were both nice girls. But that doesn't mean you are intending to leap on them at the first opportunity. Nothing. They were both civilized in their own way, and Well, we sort of smartened up a bit if they were coming over, and that was a good thing, and we tidied up a little bit if we knew that Jenny, particularly Jenny, she was a much nicer person than Jackie. But that's all. I mean, they would come out sledging with us if we were taking a run and they wanted. They had nothing better to do. Occasionally they would come out and we'd go off and race around and hand over the sledge to them and see if they could run the dogs and so on. It was very friendly in that sort of way, but very civilized.
They were there purely for leisure purposes. They weren't part of any scientific project?
No. Jackie Ronnie, Edith was her name, but Jackie was the name she was known by. Jackie Ronnie was... keeping records, making up the signals and things like that for her husband. Jenny had no role at all in the expedition apart from looking after her husband Harry. The book she wrote was called My Antarctic Honeymoon, so they'd only just, I think, been married before they left. It's a very, very amusing book if you ever come across it. But she says because of these attentions, she couldn't take on any role at all. She couldn't even mend or sew the chap's buttons on or anything like that. She was more or less excluded from the expedition by Finn and Jackie. So she was very much at a loss. I mean, she was an intelligent, bright girl. I mean, I think she probably had a university education. It was a waste. It was a great waste of any talent she might have had.
So did she ever sew on buttons for the Brits? Or do that kind of thing in the Orcad?
She would. She would have done. She couldn't... She usually came over with Harry, but often came over on her own. And would just sit there and talk to us, and which was very nice, and have a cup of tea and so on. She offered to do various things, like if she saw somebody darning a sock, she'd say, well, she'd never darned a sock in her life, but you know, what are you doing? How do you do it? So she got interested in that sort of thing. And I think if we'd been doing sort of needlework or anything like that, she'd have been very happy to join it. We were very self-sufficient anyway, so we didn't usually invite her to do anything like that. But I'm perfectly certain she would have done. She loved coming and talking to us, but she couldn't join in anything because she wasn't trained as a scientist or anything like that. I think there was one day she helped me to... I was transcribing from the worksheets into the permanent record, and she helped me with sort of figures and things, like putting down figures, and she was reading them out and I was writing them in, that sort of thing.
We must talk about your work, but let me just change the disc first on the machine.
Surely.